microphones are live. To the Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for Wednesday, January 30th, will come to order. We're going to hear from the Public Facilities Authority today in the Science Museum. We're going to try and be out of here by 1:30 because there's a capital investment hearing at 1:30 that some of us are on that committee. For you agency people who are listening and ones who aren't listening, I just want to announce that we have a memo from Senator Cohen indicating that under the temporary joint rules of the House and Senate, bills necessary to implement the governor's budget recommendations are required to be made available for introduction within 15 calendar days of the governor's budget submission. So that is Wednesday, February 6th. We'll start looking for bills. And so anybody who is listening, try and get us your bills because we want to start looking at them and taking them apart and putting them back together and things that we need to do in the legislature here. So I have officially done my duty, Senator Cohen, now to let the governor's office know that we need to see bills by February 6th. So, 7 o'clock?
8.
8? Somebody
we have
here,
7, I think.
Okay. All right. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but we're going to start listening to the Public Facilities Authority anyway. So, Executive Director Freeman, why don't you come to the table and give us your presentation?
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. Many of you, I think, know Terry Kuhlman, who was the Executive Director from the beginning of the PFA, and I was his deputy for many years. Terry retired last summer, and I was appointed to be the director, so I'm happy to be here with you today.
Incidentally, members, Terry did a great job. This might be one of the best agencies that we have. They do a really good job of taking care of our water needs and making sure that people get funded, and they're very, very good at it. And Mr. Freeman had a very good instructor, and he's learned very well also. And so I don't know, are you planning on going to Florida when you retire too, or
that's too far in the future for me.
You have little kids yet, I suppose, huh? Okay. By the way, we have a quorum. Anyway.
We have a quorum.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mr. Freeman. Go ahead with the presentation.
You should have in your packets packet of PFA materials with our little valve and pipe logo on the top. And I'll just kind of go through the overview kind of quickly, and then at the back there are spreadsheets for our two clean water and drinking water programs, and I'll explain those more when I get to those. But the PFA is a multi-agency financing authority that provides infrastructure financing programs and municipal financing expertise to enhance the environmental and economic vitality of the state, primarily by working with local governments on public infrastructure projects. PFA is an independent state agency governed by a board consisting of six state commissioners representing the Departments of Economic Development, Management and Budget, Health, Agriculture, Transportation, and the Pollution Control Agency. The PFA is essentially an infrastructure bank that manages the investments and transactions of three different revolving loan funds and several other grant and loan programs in conjunction with our various member agencies. The PFA member agencies in each of the programs, they set the project priorities, conduct the technical and environmental reviews. PFA staff do the credit review, the financial review of the communities, we set the loan terms and conditions, service the loans, coordinate funding both within our own programs and with other funders, and provide the overall fund management and program administration. We also work hard with local governments and local officials to understand the funding process and how the program requirements and particularly also their local responsibilities for the project and the ongoing operations. The PFA has statutory authority to sell up to $1.5 billion in tax-exempt revenue bonds. Our bonds are AAA rated by all three rating agencies. These are revenue bonds repaid strictly from the loan repayments and the investment earnings of the PFA. There's no state backing to the PFA bonds. They're totally separate from the state's general obligation bonds.
And Mr. Freeman, of that $1.5 billion, how much have we issued? Or how much?
Currently, we have $1.1 billion outstanding. And the PFA has total assets of $2.3 billion. The PFA receives no general fund general funds for program administration. All of our administrative funds come from fees on the loan repayments and a small amount of set-asides from the federal funds that we get. PFA administrative expenses in total are about 1% of the total financing that we provide. PFA is a small agency. We have only 8 FTEs. We do get some support services provided through deed. And then we have interagency agreements with the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department, and we provide funds to them for their administrative responsibilities related to the programs. On the back side of the first page is an org chart that just kind of illustrates the different departments that make up the Public Facilities Authority and the various programs that they are connected with. I apologize. I noticed too late to correct it in the packet that I managed to miss updating the name of my board chair and the deed commissioner, Katie Clark Sieben. I apologize for that and to her.
This is better this way. That way we can keep her straight from the other KDC.
The next page then gives an overview of the PFA programs. On the front page are all of our clean water programs, which is primarily wastewater treatment, along with some stormwater projects that are related to water quality improvements. Under the heading of base programs, the largest program that we have is the Clean Water Revolving Fund, which is a revolving loan program. Total loans to date, we've made about $2.5 billion in loans since 1989. Interest savings on those loans, because we make these at below market interest rates, total interest savings of about $612 million to those communities and their taxpayers and ratepayers. Program equity in the program is provided through.
Maybe I should ask you a question there. Why do we charge interest to taxpayers?
Well, we do charge some interest. By federal law, and this program is established under federal law, the loans are required to be, it's first of all required to be done as a loan program, but the interest rates are required to be below market interest rate. Historically, for many years, the federal government funded wastewater treatment through the construction grants program and provided various percentages over the years in grant funding to cities to build wastewater treatment plants. In the late 1980s, that changed. That grant program was phased out and replaced with this revolving loan fund, with the idea that the federal government would help capitalize this revolving fund, and then the loans would go out and be repaid, and it would be a self-perpetuating fund. And it's actually worked very well in many respects. So that's kind of the history of how it came about.
Is the interest that's being paid on these loans, is it sufficient to make up for the increase in inflation or the costs of doing other projects as the revolving loan fund is used for other projects?
It is to an extent, and I'll talk more about that in a minute, what the lending capacity of the fund is and compared to the needs and the project costs that are out there. currently, and as I said, there's an annual federal capitalization grant, and the state provides a 20% match to that. That's the equity that allows for those below-market interest rates on the loans. And then the PFA leverages those funds with our revenue bonds. Historically, each $1 of state funds has generated over $14 in construction and over $3 in interest savings. So there's a very a good bang for the buck on the state dollars. Our current 2013 intended use plan, which is our loan project list, has 118 fundable projects for about $205 million in project costs. The total PCA project priority list, which is roughly a five-year list, has projects totaling about $1.3 billion. We've also allocated funds. The PFA has from the Clean Water Revolving Fund to capitalize some non-point source loan programs, the Ag BMP loan program and the PCA's Clean Water Partnership loan program. The second bullet under base programs is the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, or the WIF program, that I think many are familiar with. The WIF program provides supplemental grants based on affordability criteria for high-cost, high-priority wastewater projects. Those grants can be used either we package them with our loan funds, or we can use those to match grants with USDA Rural Development that also runs a grant and loan program focusing on primarily on small rural communities. The grants are determined based on an affordability calculation for grants that we package with our loans. We use a 1.4% of median household income as the threshold level at which both debt service and O&M costs, once they get to that level, anything above that is eligible for some WIF grant funds. For an average community, average median household income, that's about $45 to $50 a month for an average household. So that's still a pretty high cost. And it's primarily the smaller communities that trigger these WIF grants, because in the larger cities, you've got more households to spread the costs over. For example, in the metropolitan area, most homeowners are paying roughly $20 a month, both combined for the treatment that's provided by the Met Council through its treatment plants, and then each city that operates its own sewer collection system, the total roughly $20 a month per household. Smaller communities around the state, much higher than that. $40 to $50 a month is not at all uncommon, and many communities pay significantly more than that. At the bottom of the page...
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, your question about interest triggered a thought I had about sales tax. Do the projects that are funded through this loan program, do those local units pay sales tax on the construction equipment and supplies and the like?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator, under state law, the materials that are purchased on a municipal construction project are subject to sales tax.
Thank you.
Yeah, we did that under the Carlson administration, right? That local units of government had to pay sales tax?
It's been a while.
They've been trying to get us to reverse that for years, haven't they, Senator Scully?
Well, Mr. Chair, it happened in the early 90s during a budget problem, and the cities were given a choice between paying sales tax on their purchases or receiving reductions in aids and credit, and they chose the sales tax. We have gradually been trying to remove that because we understand that it's just a property tax issue, but we've been unable to get it accomplished. The other thing that I would mention at this time is that under Governor Dayton's proposal, much of this material would receive a 20% rate reduction.
Oh, good point at the 5.5% rate, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Senator Dibble.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, it's kind of like the June accelerated. You know, it was an idea that helped us balance the budget one biennium, but can't magically unwind that. You have to account for it in a subsequent budget, and it's sometimes hard to come up with that money.
Sometimes these discussions just occur in the middle of things, so it's okay that happens. But
it's fine.
So let me ask you this question, because you alluded to the $40 or $50 a month that on the water bill that some people think is pretty high. How would we go about getting that? Either getting more aid to these small cities that can't afford to make the payments, or I guess. Bottom line would be to reduce the amount that they're paying on their water bills. We would need more funding from us, or more bonding ability, or what would be the ideal situation here?
Mr. Chair, there is a need for more funding just to keep the current structure continuing. Our loan program, this loan program right now, has through our modeling a lending capacity of about $100 million a year. So if all federal and state funding were to stop and just revolved on its own, we could do about $100 million a year. However, the needs, the demands are closer to $200 to $300 million a year. Our actual lending level has ranged from about $150 to $200 million a year, even a little more than that in some years. There's a significant need just to keep up with that kind of the current structure. The fact of the matter is wastewater treatment is really expensive, and for many cities it's the most expensive thing they'll ever build. So we do want to provide as much help as we can. There's also at the local level the operation, maintenance, and the asset management of those wastewater treatment assets is something that becomes really critical, something that I hope that we can, as the PFA and our staff, working with some other organizations, try to help cities, especially small communities, more information, more technical assistance to better operate and maintain the infrastructure that they have, and try to hold those O&M costs down, because the O&M cost is a big part of it. We can only assist with the capital cost, but the O&M in some cases is an even higher, many cases a higher amount than the capital debt service side.
Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Related to that and the cost you were saying some communities pay, generally it's in the metro area, you're talking about $20 for water and sewer. Do those cities receive some of these revolving loan funds, or do they just pay for them directly with property tax-backed bonds? That's the first part of my question. And then do we have thresholds where other cities can receive these funds or not? In our city of Elbow Lake a few years ago, did a project and our water sewer was somewhere around $37 a month, $40 a month. And as I recall, they actually had to raise their rates, and they're at about $77 a month in order to qualify for some of the at least rural development dollars, which I think were a part of a package to make their project happen. So one when you talk about the higher rates, there's lots of cities in my district paying closer to that $100 a month for that water sewer, but do we have a threshold? And so you're right with those statements, but do we have a threshold where some cities that are getting to the higher end get more preference in dollars? And do some of these dollars go to the metro area if they're only paying $20 a month for the water sewer anyways?
Mr. Freeman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom. All communities in the state are eligible for the loan program. Although we can't fund everybody, as I was just saying, and we do follow a priority list set by the Pollution Control Agency, we can fund roughly the top half or so of the project priority list. we set, on the loan program, we set interest rates based on, first of all, a base discount of 1.5% below our AAA market rate, and that's available to all borrowers. And then smaller communities are eligible for additional discounts based on population and based on the system cost as a percent of their median household income. So the smaller and the poorer the city is, the better interest rates they get. Right now, the market is so low, the best rate, our floor is 1%, and most of the loans we're doing right now are at 1%. But as we kind of get back to a more normal rate structure, the larger cities do pay a higher interest rate. And it also benefits the fund overall, having the diversity of the portfolio, a mix of small cities, large cities, metro area, greater Minnesota cities. Having that, mm-hmm. that broad portfolio helps support that AAA rating on our bonds that we receive. So everybody kind of benefits from that broad participation in the loan program. When I mentioned $40 to $50 a month as sort of the affordability level, and that's just on the wastewater side. Right now I'm just talking about wastewater projects and wastewater funds. The water side is looked at separately both by us and rural development. So yes, when you put the two together, for a community to have combined water and sewer rates of $70, $80 to $100 a month, or even more, that's not uncommon. That's not uncommon at all.
Okay. Senator Westrom, you're referring to an increase, though, right, of $100 or total?
Well, our city was in a spot where they had to raise, they did raise their rates, basically doubled them, in order to qualify for some funds. And I think that might have been more rural development funds than PFA, but maybe they went hand in hand. But it is a significant cost. And I understand your diversity aspect, it's obvious our smaller cities. Just by the average rate of $20 versus $40 or $50, you can see what this economies of scale do for larger cities versus smaller cities, and that's just a fact of the matter, I guess. But
that is very true.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to track along Senator Westrom's point, I was working with three smaller communities trying to put together a sewage plan. They're all on individual septic tanks now, and getting at your question, we had the state was fine to work with, but the federal government, USDA, came in, and they had a local share requirement or local contribution requirement that drove the cost up to over $65 a month just for the septic portion of the, and that was I think it was a federal local contribution requirement, and now I hear you're talking about $40 or $50. Can you tell me, has there been a change there, or am I mixing some of this stuff up?
It's a little bit apples and oranges. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Scott. USDA Rural Development, the federal agency, they use one. I think they used to be higher. They've dropped their number to 1.5% of median household income as their kind of threshold at which grant funds start to become available. On our side, we use 1.4%. However, it's a little bit different grant formula. We provide 80% grant above that level as sort of a mechanism to make sure that the local government is still, once they hit that level, we want them still to be concerned about controlling costs and bringing in the project close to budget. So we kind of do that 80%, 20% of the grants above that trigger level. USDA Rural Development, they do a little more, sort of a different approach that's more of a, they kind of ride herd a little tougher on the communities and look at every single nut, bolt, and screw in the plant to make sure that so that the review process is a little different there, but they use a little bit higher grant threshold. So I think overall it's fairly comparable, but it's a little different way of calculating.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and as Senator Westrom said, my recollection is that they were putting a package of funding together that included both state and federal. And so if the state is at 1.4% of median...
Mr. Chair, Senator, when we use this WIF program to match grants with rural development, they set the bar. They do the affordability calculations based on their criteria, and then we can provide up to 65% of the grant amount that they've calculated. And that allows them to... use all of their loan allocation. Sometimes they have a hard time. Everybody wants the grants, and they have a harder time with the loans. By us putting in some state grant money, they're able to fund more projects, and they've been very successful at going to their federal office, national office, at the end of the year. And because they can show the leveraging and the partnership that the state's providing, they're able to get, I think last year was something like $13 million additional funds. Half a dozen projects that they were able to fund through the national office. So there's a partnership there that works real well.
And just one final one. And did I hear you indicate that perhaps there was a lowering in the that local requirement that the federal government has? And is that from what I'm hearing, the percentages that you're talking about, they're quite a bit different than my recollection is, and it might actually be worthwhile for me to revisit these communities, because they didn't do the project because they couldn't do the $65. But, I mean, if it's at $40, I think that those communities probably would have moved forward. Is it something that would be worthwhile revisiting?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it was, I forget what year, goes back 3-4 years, I believe rural development was at 1.7% at one point several years ago, and they did drop that somewhat. But I think I know the three that you're referring to, currently unsewered communities, and they pose their own special challenges. And we have the small unsewered communities are really a financial challenge for in many ways, but financially, because they're building the whole sewer collection system and treatment from scratch, and they have very few households to spread the costs over. They become real difficult. When we work with those communities, we start out, number one, by really encouraging them to fully explore every possibility for privately upgrading the individual private septic systems and keeping them privately owned. If that's possible, that's generally the much better way to go. But a lot of times we find the communities where the lots are too small, the soils are bad, the groundwater is high. There's situations where they just can't do those individual private fixes, and they have to do some kind of community system. We've got a special program that I'll talk about in a minute to work with them, but it's difficult.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Continue, Mr. Freeman.
The bottom part of the page, the Clean Water Legacy Fund programs, these are programs that are funded from the state's the dedicated sales tax money, that a portion of which goes to Clean Water Fund, and these programs have been appropriated in the past. From that source, from that money, the governor's budget recommends $18 million for the TMDL grant program and $4 million for the small community program. And just to quickly, these programs, the TMDL grant program, total maximum daily load, are studies that the Pollution Control Agency does on a specific impaired water body, and they look at what are the sources of pollution and then determine which individual contributors to that water quality impairment, who has to do what to clean it up. And when those when those requirements come to individual city treatment plants that they have to provide some additional level of treatment, this grant program is available to pay 50% of that additional treatment cost. There's also a phosphorus reduction grant program that's very similar, that specifically when communities are being required to meet a tighter phosphorus limit than they would otherwise have to. And then there's a small community wastewater treatment program.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On those programs, if they're required to meet those levels because of the TMDL study, and they're going to get 50% of the dollars from the clean water, I'm assuming, do they then qualify for the grant programs on the other half?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, yes. In most cases, we are packaging then these grants with our clean water loans. In a few cases, for one reason or another, a community may want to the grant and not the loan, and that is possible for them to do. But they all of these programs follow the same priority list. The PCA creates a project priority list that's based on environmental and public health factors, and I'll show you that in a minute. And all of these programs follow that, so it kind of facilitates us packaging money from different sources, because if it's ranked high for one, then it's ranked high for the other as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Jensen?
We have proposed some small technical changes
Freeman,
to make these programs
work. Excuse me one
work.
Second. Mr. Jensen has a comment here.
Mr. Chairman, members, we look at the cancellations of prior appropriations. You see at small communities, wastewater cancellation of about $1 million. Is that part of what you're discussing now, and what might the reasons be for canceling that much money?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, when the small community program was first created, there was an initial bonding appropriation to that program. This is pre-constitutional dedicated funds. So the program predates that. There was an appropriation of bonding funds. We've used as much as we can of that for available projects. And now we have the other funds appropriated. So the program is still continuing. But as I mentioned, there's a technical assistance component to this as well, for the community to have a consultant try to figure out what they can do. And it's proving to be a real challenge to find sort of a solution that's both technically feasible, meets the environmental requirements, and is also so affordable. And so some of that initial appropriation we just weren't ready to use. We didn't have the construction projects ready to go, so that the time has lapsed on that initial bonding appropriation.
So we never let those bonds? Is that that?
The bond authorization just gets canceled, and
okay. They
never were sold. It was never money that we had. We just didn't have projects for it.
Do we keep the bonding authorization then, or does that just go away?
Just goes away and
goes away.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble, you want to keep the bonding
savings
authorization, don't you?
I can think of some other ideas. Also savings in the general fund for finance costs.
Mm-hmm.
It's only $1 million, though.
It's only $1 million, I think, yeah.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members, the process is to cancel the authorization
right.
and then provide a new authorization.
Right.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Jensen, but maybe the – is it 6 years that they cancel?
Chairman, it's every 4 years we review the projects.
Okay. And what's the reason for most of them canceling? They just never – they weren't ready to go, or they're just one of the ones that were planned, but they decided not to go with them, and they're not going to happen?
Mr. Chair, Senator, this bonding authorization was for the specifically for the small community program. It was I forget the initial authorization was $3 million, perhaps.
Mr. Chairman, members, this shows a 2008 appropriation or authorization of $1.5 million.
$1.5 million, okay. And basically, we just didn't have construction projects that were ready to take those funds. We did fund, we have funded, I believe, about a half dozen projects through this program, and we still have more that are working towards construction, but those the time period for those bond funds has ended.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Westrom.
I missed this. Were those grants, or were they part of the low interest loan, revolving loan program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, the small community program has its own kind of funding formula. There's the loans are made at a 1% interest rate. And then communities, the current criteria are that communities below average median household income can get a 50% grant. So it's a mix of grant and loan.
Okay.
Senator Dibble.
I'll find out later. Thanks.
Mr. Freeman.
On the back side is other PFA programs, starting with the Drinking Water Revolving Fund, which is in most ways a mirror image of our clean water program that provides funding to cities for drinking water infrastructure, treatment plants, wells, well houses, water towers, distribution systems, all of that. Works the same way. There's equity provided from an annual federal capitalization grant, a 20% state match. We develop an intended use plan of projects that are ready to go and following a priority list that, in this case, is prepared by the health department based on public health criteria. You can see, and I'll just quickly mention, we also have a small transportation revolving loan fund that we partner with MnDOT for. They kind of pick the projects, and they have a process by which they solicit those projects and prioritize those. To date, the program is started in 1999. We've made $162 million in loans, roughly, I think, two or three loans a year. You can see that in 2012, we made two loans, Albertville and Nisswa. And these are pretty typical, although there have been a variety of projects funded. But most often, it's local governments borrowing for their share of a larger transportation project. And then at the bottom, there's the credit enhancement program.
Mr. Freeman, you have MnDOT, selected by MnDOT based on established criteria. Is there a list of established criteria somewhere, or does that go project by project?
Mr. Chair, they have in their rules. I know they've developed eligibility criteria and prioritization criteria. I think it's established in their rules. I forget right offhand, but it's fairly well established in their district offices that kind of help communities put these projects together are aware of those criteria, and they do an annual solicitation of projects.
And both Senator Dibble and I might be interested in this, the TED, the TED, $20 million that the governor has in the budget. Is that in your purview, or?
Mr. Chair, the TED program is not a PFA program. That's DEED and MnDOT. So this program can also sort of, if there's a need to sort of package money, this program could be used in conjunction with TED, and that's Terry Kuhlman kind of helped kind of create the concept and got both DEED and MnDOT sort of interested in that, and it's a great concept. This is a separate program from that.
Okay.
At the bottom of the page, then, the credit enhancement program, this is a totally separate or different kind of program. There's no direct funding through this program. It's for cities and counties that are issuing general obligation bonds for specific types of public construction projects. they're able to receive a limited state guarantee by applying through this program of their debt payments on their local GO bonds, which allows them to get a higher bond rating than they otherwise could and a little better interest rate. You can see county projects, jails and law enforcement facilities primarily, and city eligible projects are sewer, water, storm sewers. So if a community is looking for funding but they don't rank high enough on our list, or for some reason they just want to go on their own to do it, this program is available and it does help save some interest costs for communities. The next page,
Mr. Freeman, does this fit into your bonding authority at all? Your $1.5 billion bond? No,
Mr. Chair, it does not affect our bonding authority. The state, when the state issues its GO bonds, they do include in their official statement a mention of the current liability under this program. There's never been any community that's defaulted. There's never been a need for that guarantee to come into effect, but they do list it in their official statements for GO bonds. The next page lists just kind of the historical record of by year the loans that have been made from the Clean Water Revolving Fund, the average interest rate, and the average discount from market rate. Every time we make a loan, we calculate an estimated interest savings that the community will receive by getting the below market rate loan from us versus if they had financed the project on their own at market rate. And you can see, of course, when the program started in 1990, interest rates in general were much higher, so our average rate was over 5%, which was almost 1.8% below what the market was at that time. And interest rates, of course, have come down significantly since then. But you can see in total $2.5 billion of loans and about $612 million in interest savings. The bottom of the page shows how the loans have been made throughout the state over those 20-plus years by RDC region, as well as the interest rates by region. And
Mr. Freeman, one rural question here. So there's a seven county metro area and a Met Council appropriation. So there's how do those two things match up to each other here?
There over the years we've had some questions about Met Council likes to think they're everything in the metro area, but we kind of remind them that we have made loans to other local governments in the metropolitan area outside of Met Council, and so we kind of break out for that Region 11. We break out Met Council separately from the others.
So Met Council gets money from you as well as the Seven County metro area gets money from you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, because Met Council owns and operates the treatment plants. I think there's now seven, perhaps, wastewater treatment plants. The Pig's Eye is the largest, but they have several throughout. They don't like to call it Pig's Eye anymore, but that's what it is. That's the largest. There's others throughout the area. So all of the local cities then operate their own sewer collection system, and those feed into the larger interceptors and treatment plants that are owned and maintained by the Met Council through its wastewater services operation.
So they don't have enough of their own money to do this? Or?
Mr. Chair, they do their own bonding, of course, and they have a AAA bond rating on their own. However, they've found that this program works well for them. It saves them some cost of issuance. Actually, our bonds have beat their AAA at times. So there's some savings for them, and as I mentioned before, it's actually really helpful for the fund as a whole because of their strength and credit quality, that their part of the portfolio really helps benefit all of the borrowers.
And that number is $1.175 billion, right? Billion would it be? Okay.
Right. Yes. The back side is a similar table for the drinking water revolving loan fund. And the program is newer, and the dollars are smaller, but it works much the same way. And then on the following page, you'll see some color bar charts, the clean water revolving fund on the top, drinking water on the bottom. This kind of illustrates the leveraging that we're able to do from the federal and state funds over the roughly 10 years that are shown here. The green bars are the project financing we've done each year. The blue are the federal dollars that we've received, and the red is the state match. And so you can see that because of the loan repayments and the recycling and the bonding that we've done to leverage those funds, there's a really good bang for the buck that we've been able to achieve from those funds. And then after that, then you come to the green spreadsheet pages, which is the clean water project priority list. And I'll, when this is a five-year list, the projects are ranked, as you can see, MPCA, PPL rank, and MPCA PPL points. So that they have in their rules a point system that assigns points, as I mentioned, based on environmental public health factors. They rank projects, I think 300 and some projects on the list for, I guess, almost $1.4 billion in total. This is roughly a five-year window of time. So the projects on this list are not all ready to go to construction. Some of these are just starting the planning process. Some of them are in the more advanced engineering design. We don't actually fund the project until it's received all the approvals, they've taken construction bids, and they're ready to go to construction. And the gray shaded lines, when they go all the way across the page, that means those projects are fully funded and under construction. The WIF program in particular has certain, because of the city's sort of need to kind of know the money's there as they're working through the process, there are milestones built into the WIF statute where we can reserve funds when a project's reached a certain point. And when you see under the WIF program, there's individual cells that are highlighted, some other programs as well. That indicates those funds are reserved and the project is continuing to kind of work through the remaining engineering work to get ready for construction. You can see, and I'll just kind of go quickly across the columns, you see the project description, the estimated cost. In some cases, there's no amount shown for the cost, which means the project's still early in the planning stages and they haven't actually developed a full-blown cost estimate yet. The column just to the right of that that says CWRF loan 2013 IUP fundable range, those are projects that are on our current 2013 loan project list. So they've completed all of the planning work. They're in the process of doing the engineering design, and as soon as they get that design work done, they've given us a schedule that says they're going to be ready to start construction in most cases this spring and summer. So the projects with dollars in that column are the ones that are anticipated to start construction this year. To the right of that, there's a column that says CWRF principal forgiveness. Since the federal era stimulus bill of 2009, there's been a requirement that some of the federal funds that come to us have to be provided in the form of grants that are packaged with the loans. And the federal government, for whatever reason, they can't bring themselves to use the word grant, so they coin this principal forgiveness term. What it means is it's when we make a loan, then sort of part of the principal is forgiven at the kind of upfront when we make the loan. This is not forgiving principal of past loans. This is projects that are starting construction now or getting ready to. So it's and what we've done in state statute, the criteria for this federal principal forgiveness is just references the WIF program. So it follows the same affordability criteria that the WIF grants do. So projects that are trigger that affordability and eligibility for that, we can, in some cases, we mix and match the WIF and the principal forgiveness to the city. It doesn't really matter, and gives us a little more of that grant money to help the high-cost projects.
So, Mr. Freeman, how do we get it applied to past projects?
Pardon me?
How do we get the loan forgiveness applied to past projects?
There is no way under the federal law for any of this to be used to forgive past projects.
Figure that one out. Okay, go ahead.
The next set of columns, it shows three columns for the WIF program. One is grant funds that were awarded or reserved prior to last year's bonding bill, and then there's a column specifically for the 2012 WIF appropriation, which was $15 million. All of those funds that were appropriated in the 2012 bonding bill are now either awarded or reserved for projects that are under construction or will be under construction this spring. You can see where those are. Some of them are dollars that we've matched with rural development, and they're completing the rural development process, and they'll be ready to go soon. And then to the right of that, there's a column that says WIF grant estimated need. That's based on preliminary information that we have from these communities, running it through the grant formulas. This is what we calculate as what those projects would be eligible for based on those current estimates. Now, the important thing to remember is not all these projects are ready to go, and so we are continuing to work with these communities to make sure we identify which ones are actually going to be ready to go to construction in 2013. And we have some of that information. We're continuing to gather that, so we'll be prepared when the time comes. Communities or projects where there's no dollar amount shown in that column means that they don't trigger the WIF affordability. So they're eligible for loans, but not the WIF grant.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. question on how, when you get back to the estimated need, quite a lot of discrepancy in there. Can you explain it to me how that happens? I'm looking at, for instance, Walnut Grove estimate project, about $5.8 million, and the WIF grant estimated need is less than half of that. Why the discrepancy?
Ms. Freeman.
The WIF grants, again, are calculated based on affordability criteria that are written into the WIF statute, and it's based on looking at what the community's, what we call the system cost, which is debt service, both any existing debt they have and also for this new project, and then O&M costs, and those numbers together divided by the number of households that they have, and when that exceeds 1.4%, the amount above the 1.4% is eligible for the WIF grants. So it's really a function of the project cost and how much above the 1.4% of that community's income are those costs. And so the grants in some cases are quite large and in other cases fairly small.
Makes sense. Thanks.
The The programs then to the right of the WIF, these are those clean water legacy programs, TMDL grants, phosphorus grants, and then the small community is divided between the technical assistance grants and the construction. And we've awarded a number of technical assistance grants. A lot of projects, as I mentioned before, are kind of trying to figure out these very small communities, what they can do, not ready to go to construction yet, but they're working on it. And then to the far right, other funders that we coordinate with, the largest being USDA Rural Development, and you can see kind of what the status there is, if they've applied to Rural Development or if they're further along. And when RD commits their funds, which they do at an earlier stage in the process than we do just because of the way it works, you can see that they commit funds. We can provide the WIF match, and so those funds are reserved. For example, Hazel Run is the first one you see there. They're working on the final engineering work right now, and then hopefully should be in, ready to go to construction this spring. There's some additional programs that we do coordinate with as well, the DEED Small Cities Development Program. These are some HUD block grant dollars that DEED receives, and a portion of those go to public infrastructure projects. And when we try to coordinate with them, and they look to us to see where projects fall on the priority list to try to match funding as much as possible. And there's a few other sources of funds there as well that come into play occasionally. Following the green sheets, and I should mention that the loan program, as I said before, doesn't have capacity to fund everybody. So what we do is each year as requests come in, we look at the volume of the requests or the loan demand compared to the capacity of the fund. And our board sets a funding cutoff, a fundable range. This year and for the past several years, that has been 45 points. And so if you look down that PPL points column and find 45, which I think is on the middle of page 5 of 7, projects that are above 45 points, 45 and above, are... And we try to hold that number as consistent as possible so that the communities know if they rank above that level, the funding is fairly predictable. They know that at least they will be eligible for loan funds when their project is ready for construction.
So is that number based a lot on what we are requiring of them? How badly their project needs to be done, whether or not they have the ability to fund it themselves. Are those some of the criteria that would determine that number?
Mr. Chair, the point criteria are environmental and public health based, so they are a lot of these projects are simply rehabilitation of and replacement of old aging infrastructure, like roads and bridges and everything else. Eventually the wastewater treatment infrastructure starts to wear out and cities have to do some major projects to rehab and replace. So a lot of these projects are fall into that category. In some cases they have additional treatment requirements that are being required under their permit by the Pollution Control Agency. That gets back to the TMDL studies and the things that I mentioned there. Those can add additional points. In some cases, there's some expansion going on as some communities are growing and population shifts. And so in a lot of cases, a city will, as they're try to tie as many of those different needs together into one project as they can just for economy. So they may have to rehab part of their project, but they may want to hold off on that. They know there's some additional treatment requirement that they have to do, or they know they need to expand. So community is sort of looking at all of those things and trying to figure out what's the best time to move ahead with a project. In some cases, it's driven by, or they may be, these are complicated projects in a lot of cases to put together. There's all the engineering issues, there's the environmental issues, there are the local financing issues, raising rates or whatever to be able to fund the project. So it can, all those things kind of have to come together. We try to help communities sort of understand how all that works, and then as much as we can help keep the funding predictable from year to year so that they know as they're working through all of those things, they have some idea what kind of funding would be available when they are ready to start construction.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Freeman, just a point of clarity on page 4, and I might have missed this, I apologize, but I look at a couple of small townships there that the projected cost is zero, and they received $25,000 from legacy money. Can you explain that to me? I'm sure I'm missing something. Is it an ongoing project, or
Mr. Freeman,
is that what I'm?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, those are a couple of, and I think it's just the one, Leaf Valley Township, that's received that small community technical assistance grant. So that's a situation where it's an unsewered area, and the priority, I guess I didn't mention this, but the priority rank of projects in unsewered areas is driven largely by the seriousness of the problem. They're at the top of the list, many, and even perhaps some of these, many of the individual septic systems are what PCA classifies as raw sewage straight pipes. And there's raw sewage that's either going into a creek or a ditch or somewhere on the surface of the ground. Those are the high priority things. There's also when there's not enough separation to groundwater, that's a second category. So there's some kind of issues, and I don't have the details for that community, but there's problems with those individual septic systems, and that. Township, and usually with township projects, it's not the whole township, it's just one particular area where they've got these problems and can't solve them, or at least they're looking for ways to deal with those problems, and they're looking at the technical assistance funds helps them hire a consultant to kind of look at the problem and figure out what they can do.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up. So there is certainly a request for those funds. How is that? That's not tracked on here, then. Is that through the MPCA? If you're requesting funds, how does it show that on here? When they're receiving funds, they must be requesting it formally somehow.
Yeah, it will show here once they figure out what it is that they're wanting to do. So the $0 amount under the project cost means they know they have a problem. They don't know what to do about it yet, so they don't have a cost estimate. They've got the technical assistance grant help figure that out.
We're getting something. Got it. Thanks.
Okay. Anything else, Mr. Freeman? How much money are you going to need from the governor's budget this year, or from the bonding bill, or from wherever you get your money from to do these projects?
Mr. Chair, I'll I'd like to defer on that right now while the governor works out. There's obviously a lot of requests and needs for capital projects and bonding. As I mentioned, you've got the list there. You can see the WIF needs. The key thing for us is we want to make sure that the appropriation needs to be in line with projects that are ready to go. And because we don't fund the project until they're ready to start construction. And so there's a lot of needs, but they're not all ready-to-go projects, and that's the part we're continuing to nail down with the communities, and we'll be ready to have better answers on that in the future.
Mr. Jensen.
Mr. Chairman and members, the bonding bill of a year ago only did the state match for the federal, I think it was a clean water program, so that would need to be included somewhere. And Mr. Freeman probably will give an estimate when the governor's budget comes out, but I think it was around $8 or $12 million a year.
Mr. Chair, last year the governor's request for the state match that keeps that revolving loan program going was cut in half. So we make the request for 2 years of future federal funding. So we got the amount we needed for this year, but the amount we need for the 2014 we do not have at this point, and that would create problems as we go into next year's project list.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Mr. Jensen, you can and I should know this, how much legacy money goes into this account, maybe on the average over the last 4 years, the two bienniums that have been put out, do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's around $22 million a year.
Let me get Dan going here.
Mr. Mueller, we woke up. There we go.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the last biennium was about $26.4 million, and the first time around was about $24 million. And in the governor's budget this year, he has $24 million.
I think there's a long-standing tradition on this committee that the chair and the former chair get whatever they want out of this. And everybody else gets to.
Since this is a good rule.
No, Senator Zaxhager.
So that wakes everybody up.
I'd throw that one out.
As long as it's
fun,
going to Better Minnesota, what do we care, right?
See, and Mr. Mueller, so you said biennium, so it's roughly right. $10-12 million a year.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's growing, too, the projections, I think, too, aren't they, Clean Water? Lassard Sams, for one, I think is $4 million more than what was projected, so that's a good outlook.
Let the record indicate that Mr. Mueller shook his head yes on the answer to the question. So,
Mr. Chair, I just note that the governor's request for these, the PFA programs under legacy, the $22 million this year is about 34% less than we got last biennium, but it was our request. We lowered our number simply because the projects aren't currently there to take those funds. I mentioned we've got some proposals for some technical amendments to try to make the programs a little more accessible to cities, and because the needs are there. Part of it is an issue just of how the program requirements, and so we will be looking to hopefully make some changes there.
Yeah, because this is a good bang for your buck program, PFA is, and I think if we can figure out a way to make it even more affordable for our small communities that don't have very many resources to pay these things back, we got to figure out a way to do it, and so maybe we can work on something like that in the very near future. So, anybody else? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. I appreciate it. We'll be in touch, I guess, during this legislative session. Who's got the Science Museum?
Who's he got?
Chair Tomasini, Senators, I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, President of the Science Museum of Minnesota.
It rhymes with the Japanese company Sony.
Okay? Sony, thank you, sir. Tomasini. I'm President of the Science Museum of Minnesota. It's my delight to be with you today. I will try to be brief and keep you on your schedule. The Science Museum of Minnesota is in the governor's budget for our requested amount of $1.079 million per year for each of the years of the biennium. And I'd like to spend a few moments talking with you about what the Science Museum does with that investment, the value that we return, and what the state can count on from the support that it offers to the Science Museum of Minnesota. The Science Museum of Minnesota has an annual budget of approximately $39 million. This is a wide range of funding sources, and the $1 million plus that we receive from the state is an essential part of maintaining our infrastructure that allows us to develop and maintain programs and service to the state, our families, students, teachers, and communities. The Science Museum of Minnesota works with a model of research that says there are three core elements to the success in education, particularly in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education. The first thing we know that every student needs is engagement. They need to be oriented to, interested in, and believing in their success for working with science education. Programs that get students engaged and turned on have to be met with programming that provides capacity for students. Capacity is the second essential element, and we speak of capacity as having acquired the requisite knowledge and skills to advance to ever more rigorous disciplinary content. You can have the most interested student in the world, but if their teacher isn't trained, if the materials aren't there, if we don't offer the best curriculum, that interest is ill-served. But if you have a student who is interested, oriented to the material, and a teacher who can teach successfully, then we need to have continuity in the system, the ability for them to advance throughout their education to programming that succeeds. We recognize that our school year in Minnesota is 180 or fewer days. That's less than half of the year. The school day is about 6 hours, less than a quarter of the day. From birth to the time a student graduates from high school, they will have spent nearly 8% of their life in school. They'll spend another third sleeping, 42% unprogrammed, 5% bathing and occasionally taking care of daily activities of life, depending on whether they're a teenager or not. But that 42 to 45% that is not otherwise programmed is the time that we have to capture a student's imagination, to get them interested in science, and to have them turned on to knowledge. At the Science Museum of Minnesota, we work diligently to get students oriented, excited, and turned on to science. More than one-third of all students surveyed said that their failure in science was never seeing themselves as a scientist. When you come to the Science Museum of Minnesota, you see yourself as a scientist. 60% of adults not in science today say that it was because they were discouraged from learning science. In an era when we put science on a pedestal, too many people were turned away from the belief that they could do science. But today, when 3 out of 5 new jobs that are being created in the future economy will require a background in science, when science learning is the fastest growing part of our economy, when the investment in science grew twice as fast as the investment in any other discipline in the last 10 years, we know that having students oriented in and heading towards a career in science is essential. The Science Museum of Minnesota wants all of our citizens to be able to participate in the issues of science. And so we work with corporations such as Cargill, providing teacher training and professional development. We work with low-income communities, providing subsidies for students who can't otherwise afford to come. We work with partner institutions such as the Arboretum, the Headwaters Science Center, and others to help create standards-based experiences. Today, with the investment that the state makes in the Science Museum of Minnesota, we have a facility that allows us to showcase a capacity to others. Because of that, Cargill has invested $2.5 million through the Science Museum of Minnesota for teacher training and professional development. Because of that, the Science Museum is at the table chairing the state standards in engineering and serving on the state standards committees for science and mathematics. Because of that investment, we have trained over 1,500 teachers this year alone in standards-based, leading-edge science and math literacy. Because of that investment, we're able to provide loans of materials to schools throughout the state. In the last 2 years, our loan program has been increased in its demand from teachers by more than 12%. We've funded that out of creative programs and partnerships, not state money. But the state money allows us to have a facility with cleaned windows, vacuumed floors, and safe habitat respecting our visitors. Our visitors are nearly 750,000 people a year. Our film programs, nearly 500,000 people a year. And our programs for students reach 1 in 6 Minnesotan students every single year. We hope that what we're giving for the investment is remarkable. Well, the $1 million is multiplied 39 times in services that we provide to our state and our region. And I want to thank you for all of the gifts that you've given to this state through the Science Museum of Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jolly. And I also want to thank you, our chair, to allow me to chair this section of our committee. And it's a great honor. I'm still very fresh. And today, my adrenaline's kind of run high, jumping back and forth. I saw this thick book about the fiscal budget, and there was a training about it, too, so I'm hopping back and forth. But I'm honored to also see Mr. Eric Jolly here, you know, as president of the Science Museum. Actually, we crossed paths almost about 10 years ago. I'm, you know, aside from being a legislator, I'm a video producer, so I did a successful story about the Science Museum holding a race exhibit called Are We So Different? And, you know, I'm just quite honored that also that St. Paul, I mean, the Science Museum is in the city of St. Paul. Is where the city that I live in for 20 years. I still miss that meadow lizard in front of the Science Museum. So, but does anybody have a question for Mr. Jolly?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Jolly, just out of curiosity, all these kids that come through the Science Museum, is there a way for you to track if their experience at the Science Museum translates into them getting more interested in science? Is there a way to track that, or do you know of any of that?
Yes.
Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomassoni.
There you go.
Give. I'm delighted with that question. The Science Museum of Minnesota literally did write the book on using research-based decision-making to lead in science education. And we are committed to collecting, retaining, and analyzing the data that lets us demonstrate our effectiveness. And our effectiveness is measured around whether or not we get students engaged, interested in science, whether or not we increase their capacity, their knowledge in science, and whether or not we increase their working continuity, their pursuing of science. Students who go through our programs are now being shown to have higher homework completion rates in school, higher achievement rates. We're closing the achievement gap as measured by the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And we were recognized just this year for our program in engineering being the most successful applied engineering teacher training program in the nation based on not simply teacher reports, but student achievement. Our measure is how do we close the achievement gap and how do we help all students increase in their success. Our measures of teacher satisfaction are simply interim measures. Those aren't adequate for us. What's adequate for us is actual student achievement. And we have data from Lemelson MIT studies, from Boston Museum of Science and the National Center for Technology Literacy Studies that support our effectiveness. Thank you for your question.
And do you remember when Senator Hurd did the film?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we had a chance to talk about this in a meeting just last week.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure Mr. Jolly had crossed paths with a number of people. And, you know, the Science Museum had so many video reel that, you know, mine's just part of it.
Okay.
But I'd like Mr. Jolly to maybe talk a little bit about the governor increase, even though the amount is nominal. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, yes, the Science Museum had intended, prior to seeing the governor's budget, to request a 1% increase. I can tell you more about that. In the materials that we've provided, I am a little embarrassed to point out a map. The map shows the reach of the Science Museum of Minnesota. And in green, we show places, counties that we reach with field trips. In light blue, in field trips. In dark blue, in outreach. These are programs that we carry to the schools. They don't have to come to us. And in light green, where we do both. Today, I have to point out there are four areas of gray. This is where our contact isn't annual. And although we're only asking for an additional $10,000, our hope is that it will be that we will be able to, next time we meet, show you a map with no gray. I want to be able to take the capacity that we bring close to our counties like Clearwater and make certain that we cross the border into Clearwater. What we hope to do is be able to serve the entire state without any exception in our statewide impact. The increased amount that we're asking for is indeed nominal, $10,000 in a budget, but it reverses a trend that the Science Museum has endured for nearly 8 years of consistent minor budget cuts. We are delighted that the governor has recognized the need to reverse the trend and offer us stability. That stability translates into our being able to give our partners, our other funding agencies, our private donors, an assurance that we are stable and we are going to be here, and that the programs that they invest in will have the foundational support from the state that allows us to commit in the longer term. And so this is really symbolic of a stability for the Science Museum, and that stability we use to make the argument for additional extramural funding.
And I will hope that the next time around when we meet, the four gray area here will turn green. So any other member in the committee have questions for Mr. Jolly?
Woman with them have anything to say?
Senator Spark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Jolly, thank you for your presentation, and obviously you were supportive, and I would agree it would be nice to be able to reach every part of the state. Do you also charge some fees to help offset your costs at the Science Museum?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we have multiple funding streams. Our streams include charging fees for teacher professional development, fees for the movies or for attendance, and group fees. These are all subsidized, and so the Science Museum is one of the largest exhibit production companies in the nation. We create and sell exhibits to other science museums around the country. We use the margin that we get for that to reduce the fee cost for our teacher professional development and for our students, and we use the state monies to help us provide a special subsidy to low-income families.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I want also to ask to see the person that accompanied you today, whether she want to speak. But before we turn it over to her, I'd like to throw you a question. Living in St. Paul for 20 years, I've seen the diversity grow so much in our state and our city. Are you satisfied with the staffing, the diversity at the Science Museum, being that it's an innovative organization? Are you satisfied with the quota of diversity right now?
Mr. Chair, the answer is no. We are satisfied that we meet the spirit, the letter, the requirements of the law, that we have very strong EEO6 category achievement, and that we exceed our partner organizations in reflecting diversity. But our satisfaction with that is not comforting. And my goal is to create a staff that not only looks like our cities and our communities, but looks like our future. And we have worked diligently to do that. We have a number of special days and signs dedicated to increasing our diversity and our appearance. We've got more partners than ever before, and we have a higher level of diversity than ever before. It is, however, not at the level that we aspire to.
Okay. Thank you very much, and may you introduce a person that will, accompany you today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. I'm pleased to introduce Brenda Rainey, our Director for Government Relations from the Science Museum of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I am Brenda Rainey, Director of Government Relations, and it's my pleasure to be here today. Dr. Jolly is a tremendous representative for us, but if you've got further questions or if there's anything in the booklet that we provided that sparks a question at a later date, please feel free to contact me directly, and contact information is on the front of the booklet. Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair and Senators, one of the great assets that Brenda has brought is writing me notes to make certain I touch upon everything, and she did want to be certain that I underscore one of our greater achievements is we now have statistically significant data that schools involved with the Science Museum of Minnesota are closing the achievement gap and closing it faster than schools not involved with the Science Museum of Minnesota throughout the state of Minnesota. And we're pleased that our professional development models have received recognition from the White House for leading change.
That's wonderful. And any other member have any additional question before we conclude Mr. Jolly's presentation? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senators.
And I shall turn over.
Just the jury.
Okay.
The meeting, I shall turn.
So, okay. Well, thank you, everybody. And the meeting is adjourned.
We're supposed to keep these?
No, I think they keep them. Don't they? Or do we keep?
Laura, are we supposed to take these with us?
You can keep.